$32 million. So when you go to now imagine, and people ask us, like, how do you get every single business case you've ever written approved? This is how, guys. It's a ground game. So I bring it up only to say, we have experts. Experts are great. We have a process. A process is helpful. We have the reality of how the process works. Okay, now we're getting people-centered. And then we find all these other points of friction and costs that you would never contemplate are connected to this process, which creates a whole different optic about why this transformation matters, which leads to more transformation and more thought processes, et cetera.
I'm the bald one. He is not.
Hey, this is William Tincup and Ryan Leary. We have Mark Stelzer on today with the You Should Know podcast. And we're going to be talking about a lot of different things because Mark and I haven't seen each other and talked in a while. So really, we're just going to use this podcast as a way to catch up. Just kidding. Mark, would you do us a favor and introduce yourself for us?
Absolutely. Hey, guys. I'm Mark Stelzner, founder and co-leader of IA. Founded IA 18 years ago, so we're fully grown adults now, apparently. And 3 decades of people transformation experience, whatever that means, guys. Maybe we can talk about that. But good to be with you. Support large-scale, big HR transformation projects on behalf of the Global 1000. But looking forward to catching up, my friends.
That's awesome. So one thing we have to cover is you're, do we say chairperson or chairman?
Chairperson, conference chair. Maybe we can just
conference chair. Just do conference chair.
Be inclusive.
Yeah. You know, I want to do that because I care. So conference chair of EPIC, which used to be called the, was it Health and Benefits Leadership Conference?
It was. So yeah, so the backstory on this is I co-keynoted with Cisco, Tech Cisco, not Food Cisco, although now I'm hungry, right, now that I mentioned both.
Or the rapper Cisco.
So it could have been.
No judgment.
He's got the same hair.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. Ryan, I'm on my way. This is like a before, middle, and after here.
We were talking to Donald Knight. He said his was a choice. Mine was not a choice.
Okay.
Like, yeah.
That's what I said to them.
That's how we started the show.
I said, well, it looks like Donald's was a choice. Yours is clearly not a choice.
I'm like, Steve Martin and John McEnroe had a love child and nobody wanted
Pretty much. But that's okay. Both guys are awesome.
There you go. Exactly.
Good gene pool.
I was chased through the airport in Paris during COVID with a guy that was convinced I was John McEnroe.
Were you carrying a racket? No, you should carry a racket.
I was like, are you kidding me? And I, you know, but
see, I'd play that up. I'd have the little armbands, the wristbands, red, white, and blue wristbands, headband on, and I'd carry a racket around.
And I only wear short shorts, as you can imagine. So, you know,
I probably couldn't pull that off, but yeah.
But anyhow, guys, so EPIC was born out of a recognition that the topic of elevating people is bigger than just health and benefits. And so in partnership with the great team at HR Executive, now their parent company, ETC and ARC, I had the great pleasure of helping to create something new with these folks. And they were kind enough to bring me in and say, you know, what should we be talking about? And you guys know this, every subdomain in HR around the world has its own event, has its own focus. There is, you know, everything you can imagine in terms of tech-led conversations, but there wasn't a lot on people centricity. So we decided that, you know, it's funny, you always come up with the website and then you figure out the name. So URL, EPICHR, but it landed on Elevate People, Ignite Change. And it's the inaugural conference. It's going to be a lot of fun. You know, there's voices that are both new and next, because, you know, certainly we want to bring thought leaders in this topic together to talk about what people centricity can mean, every subtopic therein. But to the extent that I wanted to be involved in something, it was predicated on bringing some new voices to the stage, bringing some new personalities, hearing something fresh and new. I mean, guys, we have all been around this industry long enough to probably do other people's keynotes and presentations.
100%. 100%.
That's the sad part about it.
100%. Just give me your notes. Okay, good. All right, let me tell you what's going on here.
Yeah. I'm the least important person that's involved. I'm just the MC and the person doing the introduction. But, you know, we've got dozens of really cool speakers talking about every topic you can imagine. Our good, you know, I'll give you one, our good friend Sidon, who has dealt with, you know, tremendous loss and grief. He's bringing that to the stage. He's talking about comfort communications, like things, things we don't talk about that real people experience every day that we as people leaders, you know, need to contemplate and that our employees and their families are dealing with. That's what this is all about. So I'm super pumped and looking forward to getting this going in late April.
What type of title or company or, you know, size of company, what are we looking at in terms of the audience? Who do we want there?
Yeah, no shape and size necessarily. We want people leaders. I want business partners. I want rewards leaders. I want, you know, CPOs and CHROs. I want people that are thinking about people, that spend every day thinking about the care and feeding, the life and well-being, the hearts, the heads, you know, the bodies of the people that are the lifeblood of their organization. That's what we're looking for. And there really is no size limitation. I mean, this isn't about selling a bunch of goods and services. This is about starting a conversation. And I'll tell you guys, the other thing that I've also noticed, I mean, we've been collectively, guys, we've been at what, hundreds of conferences probably over our respective careers.
Oh, yeah.
And you walk away from a really inspiring or interesting, you know, speech, and then about a day or two later, it's etch a sketch, right? You've lost everything. And part of what was really important to me is that this is actionable. I want people to have some immediacy, take these ideas and bring them forward in whatever priority makes sense. We have workshops on the last day that are intentionally about how do we take what you've learned and how do you bring it to life in your organization? How do you take concepts and bring it into something that's measurable, not because we of course all need an ROI on the travel and the expense and the opportunity costs, but because frankly, I'm sick of being involved in conferences that are all talk and no action. So, you know, to the extent that I can help shape this, that's our ambition. And, you know, we're really looking forward to it.
I love it. I love it. Excited to see it. And let's keep going down that path, though. You talk about people transformation. What's keeping you up at night right now in, we'll just say, people transformation? What are you thinking about?
It's exhaustion, honestly. And this isn't, you know, this is mental fatigue. This is financial fatigue. This is you know, physical fatigue. We are tired. I mean, this pace, we cannot keep up this pace. And I go from all the way to the top of the organization, the pace of innovation and ideation and new market entry and new capabilities and new products and new this and that. You know, the C-suite leaders that I spend a lot of time with, you know, behind closed doors, when they hold up a reflective surface and really take a moment to pause, get out of the whack-a-mole hole and look at themselves clearly and concisely, they are beat. It is hard. We're seeing unprecedented turnover at that level. And then you start to cascade that down to the millions and millions of people that are undergirding, you know, the chaos in this world. It's impossible for anybody to keep up and to keep up well. So a lot of this, Ryan, that we're finding is how do you bring yourself to work, which has always been the ambition, but how do you protect yourself in doing so? How do you create space? How do you create boundaries? I mean, look at the cool tools you guys are using today. Like, there's no shortage of connective, omni-channel experiences, right, that can keep us engaged. But how do we shut it off? How do we turn it off? You guys will laugh. I went to a physical today. I haven't had a physical in 3 years. And the guy he's like, how's your sleep? I'm like, I said, well, how's your sleep?
Don't judge me. Don't judge me.
This ain't Planet Fitness. I'll judge you back.
and he's like, it's hard. Because why? Because he works for a really innovative organization that's using messaging and email and video and chat. Mm-hmm. And all these digital tools. So, you know, even in his case, and he's a caregiver, like if he doesn't shut it off or put boundaries around his hours of working, he could work 24/7. And simple reminders, of course, like, hey, don't look at that screen at night. Well, guess what? What's hard when you're working hard is you want to escape. And that last moment, like that first moment of quiet, sometimes is putting on those, you know, putting in those earbuds or those headphones mm-hmm. on that little screen in the dark, you know, flashing in your face, which is keeping you awake. I want to watch a show or listen to a wonderful podcast like this and do something other than live in my world at work. So, you know, the trouble in the battle is real, my friends, and it's pervasive. No one can escape it right now, unfortunately.
Is there any parallel to the what you do at IA and seeing people transformation? And again, you've been doing it for a while. And seeing what's wrong in people transformation and then helping with this conference in terms of making it people-centric. Am I drawing a line between two dots that don't exist?
No, you are. And I think part of this is this tendency to use, you know, big $10 words to describe the ambitions of the organization that for the average individual may be meaningless. So, you know, how do you, I talk about this a lot, but like, how do we bring content into context? So it is really simple to put up. I mean, we've all been part of EVPs and the aspiration, factual, functional, inspirational, whatever it's intended to be, of what we mean to stand for. And then every employee has a million examples of a couple times it worked and a million times it didn't. And so really, this is about being bespoke to the individual. How do you get people transformation? Yes, you can have goals and objectives and KPIs and measures and do sentiment surveys. But if William isn't moved by it, and if Ryan isn't moved by it, did we transform? Well, maybe we changed a process, or we changed a policy, or we de-risked something, or we introduced new tools. But when I show up every day and I kick open that laptop, or I go into that manufacturing site, or I, you know, open up that storefront, is my day any different? Is anything materially changed? Am I better off than I was, or at least at parity to how I was the day before? That's real people transformation. And a lot of it is going back to employee centricity, which I know is obvious. You know, I just put up a piece a couple of weeks ago for HR Executive on, you know, how AI is amplifying the employee experience again. And the reason it's amplifying the employee experience is because of the dehumanization of what AI brings. And so the need to overcorrect and think about how AI makes us more human is actually not something that we talk about. It's not vogue. We're talking about tools and capabilities. So guys, that's the problem. That's where the rubber hits the road. And I would say then part of that is having honesty and transparency in your organizations. And that's difficult, right? Because it's scary to basically either admit, I don't know.
Try vulnerability.
Or I don't know what that means for you.
Right. Yeah, and that's vulnerability meets ambiguity.
That's right.
And things that are most people are uncomfortable with.
100%.
So the question that I'm thinking about in terms of transformation is, does one know in the midst of transformation that things are being transformed? Or is it that you can look back and see the transformation happened?
There's probably two schools of thought, which I think can both coexist. One is that it should be frictionless. It should be, you know, as people like to say, in that flow of work. It should be natural. It should be organic. If I have to think about it, then I've created a process that's too difficult to maybe bring everybody along for the ride. And then the other part of it is being intentional about why we're doing this, what we're trying to achieve, and, you know, how should it feel? And it's funny, you know, it's really interesting. We talk a lot with our clients about measurement. You know, it's very vogue to think about KPIs or OKRs or, you know, big consultancy measures or advisory measures that would say, okay, we've moved from A to B to X to Y to Z. But really what I find super encouraging is several of our clients, really, really big, some of the biggest organizations in the world, say, yeah, that's good, but what really matters is how do my employees feel? So the only measure that matters, the only measure that matters is sentiment.
Right.
And even if the perception of that is it's better, even if we know that actually the reality is the employee may not be as healthy as they could be, they didn't take advantage of all the wonderful things we have. Right. But if they perceive that things are better day over day, week over week, year over year, and their families feel that way, maybe that's what it's all about. Maybe that's true transformation at its heart.
How are these companies measuring sentiment? I know, obviously, tools and tech and all that, but how are they really measuring it? What are they looking for? And how does that differ? I know you're working with large organizations, but as you come down, you know, say 500 person organization, where does that change? Or does it change?
Yeah, I think it's both the said and the unsaid. I think people express sentiment in a wide variety of ways. And I think, frankly, one of the challenges is that, you know, we do micro surveys and pulse surveys, and that there's the notion that one medium and mechanism is going to tell us where we are. Right. Ryan, we did work for a client many, many years ago. You all have been in restrooms where you've got the little smiley face monitor, right?
Oh, yeah.
Food. I'm kind of afraid to touch those things, though.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Like, gotta wash your hands after.
My son has to push all the buttons and type all the words. So, yeah. But we work with this organization who had a really interesting idea. They put one of those same, literally the exact same smiley face kind of pain meters at the entrance and exit of their manufacturing facility. And what all they measured is how did you feel when you walked in and how did you feel when you walked out? That was it. Touch the button. How did you feel when you walked in and how did you feel when you walked out? And it sounds so obvious when you say it, but what they could then notice is they could notice trend lines by shifts. They could look at the pressure on manufacturing or production. They could sense if there was an injury, right? If someone was injured, God forbid, on the floor. They could tell when management shifted. They could track it around meetings and interventions and everything.
So basic.
A simple measure, right? We want to ask all the questions and we want natural language to extract, you know, here's what we said, but here's what we really meant. Here's what my face read as. And if you're a reflective surface like me, you can barely even, you know, capture my sentiment. But at the end of the day, like, simple works. And another way of measuring sentiment is talking to people, right?
Yeah.
We have organizations that, like, are finally realizing that the front line is where all the intel is, all the intel, right? We can ask our customers, et cetera, but the people that actually work with customers every single day, they probably know more than those that get separated layer after layer after layer. So it's all the things. It's not a or, but it's an and sometimes simpler is better.
What role does communications play in both being people-centric as well as also in transformation? So I'm trying to draw, again, those two dots between these two things. What role do we need to actually play up or over-index or under-index in the role of communications?
Well, and it's ironic, this notion of sort of, we want it to be organic, but we also need to foster and facilitate. And therefore, you know, historically, change in comms, like the investment in change in communications, was the first line item to be cut. Right. So we advocate really, really strongly to make sure that's front and center. But I will also say that those organizations are shrinking. And the perception is that a lot of those assets now can be digitized, can be dynamically created, and we truly need humans to be involved in that work. But putting that aside for a moment, communications are critical, but communication in the form and format, and I would say in the language, and I mean literally the language, also the contextual language that our employees speak. If you talk to communications professionals, most of them would say, you know, we're pegging at an eighth grade communications level.
So USA Today.
Exactly. That's how we're going to go to market. And that's how we're going to reach the majority of the people. Well, guess what? That may be insulting to some people, but that, you know, as we're embracing, if we really believe in diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, everyone learns differently, you know, we have to think about all the channels and all the medium, all the consumption. Yeah. So I see this every single day. So comms is critical. And the fact that we are imposing change at times that is inorganic, that is going to require difficult conversations. And we can't ignore the fact that this requires a lot of investment. And it also requires time and lead time. And what I mean is sometimes these changes are perceived to be so confidential, guys, that the temptation is wait until 10th, 11th, 11th and 59th minute. Surprise. Yeah, exactly. Gotcha. And suddenly we expect that people are going to show up next day, log in, and I'm there. Logins and clicks. And
totally get it.
On day one. That doesn't mean I've changed a damn thing. So that's where we advocate for more transparency. We get that there is sensitivity. We live in the real world.
Right.
But we also can respect people as adults and humans and bring them along the journey with us.
What's the goal in, I guess, in your opinion here, maybe, or what are you seeing as the goal in transformation? Is it happiness in the workplace? What exactly are we striving for?
Ed, before you answer, I had a similar take, and it was like, is transformation ever done?
Transformation is never done.
Okay, so both of y'all.
I've been working on this beauty for a long time. It ain't done yet. 45 years of transformation here, baby.
So it's interesting that because when we talk to clients and we talk about a bespoke project, project has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's all kind of a nice little shoebox.
Yeah.
But it's There's no end to, right? Like we can all agree, there's no end to this. It's just you go into another part needs to be transformed.
Well,
it's
100%. And it's the biggest mistake is to create the logo cake and have that celebratory moment and raise your virtual champagne and say, we have arrived. Congratulations.
Done. Made it.
Celebrate that is like 0.5 of a multi-year journey because it is continuous. I mean, we're not static. I haven't seen you guys in a while. Like we're always changing. Life is changing. And frankly, we have no idea what's happening in people's lives. So the notion that there is a fixed moment, yes, we have deliverables and we have capabilities and things we want to create, but the mistake that we're seeing and the reason there's so much tech debt and so much latent capability that is unused in terms of organizational capability is because we're thinking about this too much in a fixed mindset. So it may sound like completely antithetical to how you would run a business for 18 years, but we come in with the notion of trying to get ourselves fired. Like and this is for your listeners, if you go to ihateconsulting.com, it redirects to our website. I'm not kidding. I couldn't believe it was available, which is kind of amazing.
That's pretty good.
Why do I hate consulting? Because the ethos of consulting is typically, let me get my hooks in you, and I'm gonna bleed you for years. The way I shaped our organization and the way our great team and our great clients use us is like, no, we're player coaches. I want to teach you how to do what we do because you should never spend another penny on us. You should never come back to us. And I mean this. I want to teach you how to do continuous improvement because you have to. And guys, where we're seeing organizations really pick up this mantle is now there's the creation of these HR transformation offices or people transformation offices that are ingesting all these projects, programs, and initiatives, going through prioritization, thinking about capability and tooling and investment, best use of internal and external resources, et cetera, because it's dynamic, it's ever-changing. It's not a fixed point in the sky. And that's the only way that, frankly, I think this works.
Ryan, I stepped in on your question. I apologize. So
I forgot what it was. We'd have to rewind the tape.
No. What's the role of the C-suite in both being people-centric and in transformation? And the reason why I have that in my head is about 150 years ago, I used to do Salesforce implementations. Mm. I probably did 20 of them, so the data set is not that large, but out of the ones that were successful, it was the CEO that used Salesforce. If the CEO used Salesforce, the implementation went swimmingly.
Yeah,
everybody got on board. If the CEO or the CRO, VP of sales, whatever, wasn't involved in Salesforce, they just wanted other people to be using Salesforce, the implementation went sideways. Always. Always. Yeah. So if we're trying to build, if we are people-centric, first of all, it's not a slogan. If we are people-centric, what's the role in that? And then in transformation, what's the C-suite's role in transformation?
Two things. The front and back of that I would put are empowerment and engagement. the number of decisions, the tens of thousands of decisions that are really involved in a sustainable transformation, and Ryan and William, to your questions, like continuous transformation, right, means you have to trust that there are people that are smart and that are capable, that are making decisions in the best interests of the people and the organizational goals, and they are empowered and you've got their back. And what we're finding right now is the decision authority is not moving down, it's actually moving up. Where even at times the C-suite is taking things to the board that you would be shocked by, because there is a little bit of fear right now that people are placing the wrong bets in the wrong categories, and that accountability therefore is going up. So we've got to push that empowerment down the organization and then lift people up and celebrate the empowerment, even when that empowerment sometimes leads to a risk or a failure, that I've got your back, we're going to pick up and we're going to run. And that goes to engagement. The best thing that a C-suite member can then do, and William, your call, it's exactly right, is engagement, like demonstrable engagement. And sometimes that means just a series of videos, you know, to remind people that I'm still here, I'm present, this is important, this is critical, imperative. Sometimes engagement is literally the ground game, like I am there for these moments, I am recognizing these moments. Sometimes engagement takes the form of I am talking to real people all over the organization about what this meant for them, what this unlocked in them, what this brought to life for them and their families. Engagement can take, so both of these can take any form or format you can imagine. But if you miss one, or God forbid you miss both, you are guaranteed, you are guaranteed to fail.
What's causing the fear?
The cyclicality now is smaller, and I'd say the risk profile is higher, in the sense that the perceived risk of missing whatever, you know, boat or imperative you're supposed to be on is never, and the speed at which things are, the velocity is sort of unprecedented. So people are getting whipsawed left and right. And therefore, if I'm making a bet with imperfect information, which is frankly your responsibility as a C-suite member, or you know, you're an SVP or you're a VP or you're a senior director and you move down, the question is, what don't I know, or what didn't I know? And therefore, is everyone informed? Have I shared that risk across my peer group and others, where we all signed off and we all move forward? And then when it comes to, you know, micro decisions and macro decisions, how much consensus were we able to drive? And I'm seeing a lot of movement toward consensus culture as well, which on one side brings more inclusivity, which I'm glad to see, but on the other side is a paralytic to action, and therefore impeding progress. So I think, Ryan, I think it's all about risk. I think people are really fearful of what the impact, good, bad, or indifferent, might be of making the wrong call. Yeah.
Well, some of this is, it's 1995 and the internet's right around the corner. Yep. We know it's right around the corner. Yep. Some of us are already playing around on the internet, but we don't know what bets to make and what's going to actually play out, what's not going to play out, et cetera. AI, in some ways, Gen AI is doing that to us. It's created some analysis paralysis, where it's like we don't know which decisions to make, which bets to make. But the question I wanted to ask you is around people, process, and technology. And the transformation projects that you've done in the past, that you've been involved in, what I've seen is sometimes people make the bet that if we bring in this technology, it'll solve our problems.
Right.
And sometimes people are process oriented and they think, well, we just need to re-engineer the process and that'll solve our problems. I haven't seen where if we just get the right team together, that'll fix everything. Although my inclination is that's probably more accurate. But I have seen the technology, it happens in our world, and I know you know this, it happens in our world, if we pick the right technology, it's going to change everything. And every time someone says that to me, I'm like, yeah, technology is not going to change anything. If you're rotten at process, or if you're rotten as a team, your collaboration, etc., you're just putting new tech on something that's already broken. So, like, that's not going to help anything. But you're the expert. So as you look at the transformation projects that have been super successful, what do you attribute that to?
Process-led and people-centric with tech enablement. Tech's the, right. text the accelerant, right? I think of things as like accelerants and distractions. So I'll give an example. We worked with a very large brand name retailer, part of the largest luxury holding company in the world. And they had a transformation project that we were part of. And we were at headquarters and we did lots of process mapping, like forensic HR ground game work that, that was corporate's perspective of how things work. Very smart people, domain experts, like COEs, right?
This is how they thought it worked.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's great.
This is how a lot of processes start, right?
Like
you get your SMEs and you bring them in a room and you try to document, you know, maybe current state to the best of your knowledge. But then we didn't stop there. We went in the field and we went to their stores. We said, okay, so pick a process like onboarding. We went to a store and we said, okay, what happens when someone is onboarded? They said, well, we take this piece of paper. I'm like, paper.
You lost me a paper.
Bear with me. We take this piece of paper and come behind our store, first of all, and there's file cabinets, and we file it. I said, okay, then what do we do? Well, we copy it, and then what do? Well, we overnight it, like UPS or FedEx. I'm like, then what do? Well, then Iron Mountain comes, and Iron Mountain also scans it and digitizes. And then what do? Well, then we put it in our system of record as well. Then we went back to headquarters and said, well, what happens? And they're like, yeah, we do get all the, and 400 stores, and the store's going to wait till Friday.
All the paper. Why are all these FedExes happening?
Exactly. And then we said, well, what happens when you get to these finally? Well, we unpack them. And I said, well, where do they go? And then they took us up to the 32nd floor of a downtown San Francisco building. And it was covered with cages. And guess where we're in the cages? Boxes and boxes of paper with no policy around retention, document retention, et cetera. So you would think a traditional transformation would go to corporate. You would document the process. You'd look at the current spend on the tech. You'd compare it to the new spend from the RFP. You'd go one for one. You'd say, are there any people impacts? And that would be your whole story. Well, guess what we found? We found about $3.5 million in shipping from this one process.
Jesus, just for paper.
Yeah. And we found $32 million in them leasing the 32nd floor.
I was going to ask you that. What did the 32nd floor cost?
Right.
In San Francisco?
Yeah, in downtown San Francisco.
$32 million.
$32 million. So when you go to now imagine, and people ask us, like, how do you get every single business case you've ever written approved? This is how, guys. It's a ground game. So I bring it up only to say, we have experts. Experts are great. We have a process. A process is helpful. We have the reality of how the process works. Okay, now we're getting people-centered. And then we find all these other points of friction and costs that you would never contemplate are connected to this process, which creates a whole different optic about why this transformation matters, which leads to more transformation and more thought processes, et cetera, over the process that everybody and nobody owns called onboarding. So, you know, and there's a million of these examples, guys, but we believe you got to have a point of view.
Right.
And in lieu of a point of view, your tech and tool providers are happy to take their delivered functionality and their SIs 100%. Are happy to come in and you'll pay that license on the first day of configuration. And that SI will charge you time and materials forever, but will you ever reach your intended destination?
And do they know how to unlock all of those? No. And do they care? I mean, I don't want to throw any shade at anybody, but that's not really their business.
No, and that's why, like, it takes all these parties to work together, but it is the organization's accountability and responsibility to have a point of view. And that point of view, Ryan, to your continuously is going to change and it's going to evolve over time. So we got to build some fluidity in this as well. But that's the best combination that we're seeing.
Yeah. So I've got two questions, probably not related at all. So answer if we have time. So I'm really curious to hear examples or stories of where transformation just was through the roof, something you're really proud of that you worked on. And then the other part to that is, how does a company know, outside of just a gut feeling from the CEO or the CEO, how do they know they need a transformation?
Well, they don't have a choice. I'll answer. If you don't think you need a transformation,
you've already failed.
Yeah, then you're digging your own grave. Yeah.
Eventually. So you're going to answer both questions. Fantastic. We're good.
So everyone has an impetus for change, what the focus is, what the concepts are, what the impact's going to be, who it's for what outcome, for what purpose. Of course, that's always going to be unique to every single organization in the world. And again, constantly changing, which is why we got to have somebody looking after this stuff. But the transformations that we're most proud of is when we held up something that organizations couldn't look away from. And I'm going to give you maybe a pretty controversial example that you will appreciate. And you may say, well, why would you measure this as success? And you'll understand in 2 minutes. So we worked with a large multinational holding company who will go unnamed, 120 different entities that they own around the world, European headquartered. And we had a meeting with the CEO and the entire C-suite. This C-suite has two female leaders. One is the CHRO, and the second is the president of the smallest business unit. In this meeting that was supposed to be 60 minutes, our process, we went 2.5 hours because the CEO wanted to fight. Like, he wanted to fight. Okay, if you want to fight, I want to fight. But the misogynistic tendencies of this particular CEO with his bro on the left and his bro on the right made me force something in the room that had nothing to do with the process, but had everything to do with the organization transforming.
Yep.
There was a moment where I asked him, I said, can you hold eye contact with your two female leaders for more than 15 seconds? I said, I want all the men in the room to turn their heads away and let's call them Greta and Sally. I said, first, I want you to look at Greta and I want you to hold eye contact with her sincerely, like look at her and engage with her.
Right.
You know, and I said, and now I want you to do the same. And the guys are laughing and everything else.
It's not a joke.
And the reason I'm doing this is all the expertise around everything that we've described to you is already in this room. It's already in this room. If you would listen and you would embrace the knowledge and the ideas that everyone, including these two, can bring to you, that will lead you to the type of change that you're looking for. And it was so you would think I'd be talking about metrics and outcomes and success. And instead, one of my most successful transformations was fighting with the CEO, who, by the way, afterwards in the hallway came up to me and shook my hand and said, you know, that was really good. Like, that was an amazing conversation that we had. Fought with me the whole time. And then I found out after we left the room, came back in and said, you know, we probably should listen to what these folks told us to do, even though he wouldn't agree with anything we said while we were in the room. So,
right. Of course.
So Ryan, I feel like if we can open eyes and we can open hearts and we can change ways of working and we can recognize that in most cases, all the answers exist. We just need a method to organize them and funnel them toward, you know, some imperative for good, then I can retire. and that's the goal. Yeah.
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
Want to get fired? Want to get fired? And I want to retire.
Yeah. What are you guys concluding from this conversation?
So let's go back to Epic for a couple of minutes real quick.
Sure.
You mentioned that you want to really tease out the voices that are next and now. How do you find those? Like, what's the, you know what I'm saying? Like,
that's hard.
We all know the same people, so that's great. But like, how do you figure out the people that you don't know?
Yeah, it was a really cool process. So the call for speakers was really, really early, which again, if there's any conference organizers out there, that cast such a broad net and gave enough time for us to make sure that everybody knew that this existed and that this was new and that you were wanted. We had over 400 submissions for this event.
Wow.
400 submissions. And so I read every single one. I went through all of them. I gave feedback. When the unfortunate notices go out, which we've all been on the receiving end of, the offer that I had them put in is, if you want more detail, reach out to Mark and he will give you feedback. Right. And many did, and I did give them that feedback. But what it gave us a chance to do is to curate, because we bought ourselves enough time to curate a combination of individuals. And it's an incredibly, I'm so proud of like the diversity of voices and perspectives and individuals that are participating. It's probably one of the most diverse events that I've ever seen. And it's not lost on me that this white guy over 50 is the one facilitating this. But when we talk about putting myself out of a job, my goal is to bring more people into the conversation and get out of the way. We don't need to hear from me. We need to create space to hear from everybody else. So that's exactly how we did it. That's how we found people that exist, that have something to say, but never had the opportunity to say it. And I'm super, super proud. And I'd say that goes for topics too. Even the people, some of the people that we know, are took the advantage of the moment to lean into hard topics, like stuff that is not necessarily the sexy or exciting or, you know, most innovative things, but it's the hard things of what it means to be a human in today's world. And I'm super proud of this cohort of amazing speakers and presenters and frankly, how they're intending to show up. And I'm excited to see the fruits of their labor for sure.
What's success? Like when you get done and you're doing your reflection or postmortem or et cetera, what's success for you?
Sentiment. It's exactly where we started, guys. So I'm a story person at heart. Like I want to hear how it impacted people, the attendees. But as importantly, I want to hear how they took that information and how it impacted their teams and so on. And that effect is, you know, why I did this. Like this isn't, you know, I never had aspirations to necessarily be a conference chair. But you know, you got to be careful, right? You complain that you want something better and you got to help make it better. Exactly how I got here. I'll applaud the team at ETC and ARC and HR Executive that really leaned into the moment because, you know, we challenged them to try some new things and do some new things. I'll give you another example, guys. Here's about impacting people. So we called MGM and we said, MGM, who leads philanthropy at MGM? How many events have we been at MGM?
Oh, good God.
So we got to the head of giving for MGM International. And we said, what can we do as an event to bring giving, a giving campaign to those who you know in Las Vegas need help? Who knows better than you? Right. And so we're doing, it hasn't been announced yet, but I'll share this here. We're doing a giving campaign. We're creating hygiene kits, et cetera, that my firm is actually supporting because I think this is important. We're all together to do good. This isn't about a sponsorship and someone throwing their brand on something. I don't want any recognition for it. But what's important to me is we're at the MGM. They know who in the community of Greater Las Vegas needs help. Why don't we take the hundreds and hundreds of hearts and souls that are going to be there and let's put it in something good. So that's important as well. That's another way of measuring impact. That's what I care about. I want stories. I want to hear that this actually led to something. Not that it was a great keynote, but that it was a keynote that moved someone to action.
You know, the action part, because you're doing workshops on the last day, getting people to action, you know, getting the people to kind of create a plan for how to take this stuff that they've learned or been inspired by, et cetera, and put it into place. There's a long tail to that. You know, it's almost like you could book in this with the next year's conference and start off with, okay, what did we learn from last year? What do we put into action? Okay, where did it get this, you know, where did we derail? What worked, et cetera. So I could see if we do this, if you just do it 2 weeks after, everyone's still high off the conference, right? Everyone's, if we do it right, if they're educated, they're inspired, they're entertained, everyone's still feeling that feeling, but a year later, have those actions been kind of pulled through? I think you can do kind of a longitudinal study, if you will, of those actions actually being implemented.
I think that's a brilliant idea, and I think every event has the notion of keeping the conversation going, right? Like that's always an ambition.
Right.
I don't think that, frankly, there's a lot of good examples in the event industry of people doing that at scale and doing it well. So, you know, I hope that other event organizers who may listen to this beg, borrow, and steal from, you know, whatever they can learn, because you're 1,000% right, William. That peak is high. Like we all feel really good generally coming out of that, the sense of community and connection, you know, with our tribe. here is fantastic, but the valley is really low. And honestly, sometimes it's the cognitive dissonance of the inspiration you heard and then going back into your job, knowing you can't change a damn thing, actually makes it worse that you ever went in the first place.
I'd rather not know.
I'd rather not know, because now I've seen, you know, or heard what good or great could look like. And oh my, I'd like to see a correlation between how many attendees attend conferences and how quickly they look for new jobs.
Yeah.
That's
actually pretty interesting.
That would be an interesting study, right? Which is, oh my God, you made me see, again, I go back to reflective service. I looked into the mirror.
I went to go join the new world.
Yeah, to go join that, which I think is, you know, and honestly, I think, you know, those organizations that participate on panels and keynotes and success stories, you know, it's good of them to do that, because that's a recruiting moment too. There's no miss in trying to tell a story that might draw someone into your brand and into your organization. So I encourage practitioners, of course, to continue to participate, but we got to do better to make it real and make it sustainable. 1,000%.
And if done right, telling stories can be super educational.
100%.
It's highly valuable. So, exactly. William, any last questions for Mr. Mark here?
Not at all. It's been wonderful.
It has been, Mark. Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it. And if you're still watching, you're listening, follow us, like us everywhere, do that thing. If you see us out somewhere live, come say hello. I'm the bald one. He is not.